All right. Thank you, everyone, for attending today. My name is Sarah Causer. I work at the Institute of International Education on the Outreach and Recruitment Team, and we're really happy to have you here. If you are attending this webinar, it's because you have either hosted a foreign language teaching assistant or an outreach lecturing fund on your campus, and you're looking for more ways to get involved. So we're really happy to have you here. I apologize, the date on this one is incorrect on this slide, so I do apologize for that. But I quickly want to have the rest of my colleagues introduce themselves, starting with Kaylee.
Hi, everyone. My name is Kaylee Smazniak. I also work at IIE. I'm a placement advisor with researchers and scholars, so visiting Fulbright scholars and then foreign students.
Great. And David, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm David Levin with the Bureau of Education and Cultural Affairs of the Department of State.
And we are also joined by two wonderful alumni host institutions. I'm going to start first with Suzanne at Davidson County Community College. Suzanne, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. Hi, everyone. I'm Suzanne LaVenture. I am the Director of International Education at Davidson County Community College in Thomasville, North Carolina.
Great. And last but certainly not least, Vilma, would you also like to say hello?
Of course. My name is Vilma Fuentes. I'm Assistant Vice President for Academic Affairs at Santa Fe College. And as part of my portfolio, one of the major things that I have is responsibility over international education, international grants, international cooperation agreements. So obviously anything Fulbright related or related to ECA falls to me, and I'm delighted to be involved in these programs.
Great. Thank you, everyone. Well, just as a quick kind of summary, the system that we're using actually allows you to ask questions. We will have a question and answer section at the end, so feel free throughout the presentation to submit questions for either Kaylee, myself, or David, who work on, you know, administering and running the program and sponsoring it in the case of David, or if you have questions for our kind of wonderful alumni hosts, Suzanne and Vilma, please submit them at any time. We'll ask those at the end. Additionally, this webinar is being recorded, so we will send this out to everyone who did register once it's archived and online. So moving right along, because we have a lot of content for you today, this slide is just really telling you kind of the presentation overview that we'll have. I will quickly do a quick introduction and overview of the Scholar in Residence program. Kaylee will then kick it off with application components, tools, and resources, and then we'll really get into the heart of this presentation, letting you hear from these wonderful host institutions and how they really worked with the Scholar in Residence program. We'll then wrap it up with a Q&A section. So we will get started now. So the Fulbright Scholar Program was established in 1946 by a junior senator named J. William Fulbright with the goal of sending U.S. academics and professionals overseas and bringing scholars and professionals from abroad to the United States. The goal was really to engage in people-to-people diplomacy. It is sponsored by the U.S. Department of State Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs, and if you have any questions about that, they would be more than happy to shine some more light on that. And we have been thrilled at IIE to administer the program since its inception. Continuing on, the Scholar in Residence program is just a small but wonderful piece of that overall Fulbright family. The goal of the Scholar in Residence program is to bring scholars and professionals from abroad to your campuses. So you would actually serve as a host institution submitting an application to either name a scholar or request us to recruit a scholar, and Kaylee will touch on that. This opportunity allows you to bring a visiting scholar to your campus for either a semester or a full academic year. They would primarily be teaching undergraduate courses, and you would really set up what you wish to have, whether which country it is, what discipline, what you need them teaching. Are they creating new courses? Are they really bringing in an international perspective to already established courses? Really, kind of the world is your oyster in regards to this program. The application deadline is on October 15th, and if you have any questions, Kaylee and I will probably refer to the email on the screen multiple times, but you can get in touch with us through fir@iie.org, and we'd be more than happy to answer any questions you might have. One thing, and I'll touch on this later, that really sets this program apart is the fact that Haley and I are really here to help you. They actually have, the program has an additional kind of proposal draft deadline on October 1st. So if you submit anything up until October 1st, Haley and I will look at it, review it, and give you feedback on how to make that application stronger. And you don't find that with any other Fulbright program, and you'll probably hear us say that just a few times to really say this is what sets us apart. So on this page, you will see the program benefits and the goals of FIR. I'm actually going to pass the microphone over to David to really talk about how this program helps increase mutual understanding and globalization. David?
Sarah, thanks very much, and thank you all for tuning in. If you know Fulbright, which I know all of you do, it's typically seen as a program for Americans to study or teach or conduct research abroad and for foreign citizens to come to the United States to do the same kind of thing, individual grant, shall we say. But SIR, like the Outreach Lecturing Fund and like FLTA, are the three programs that are institutionally driven. So it's really up to you as an institution to determine specifically how you would get involved with these three programs. So with SIR, it's unique in the sense that it's maybe the best program for broad internationalization across campus. So you invite a scholar to campus, as Sarah said, for a semester in academic year. They're teaching undergraduate classes. They're also engaged in a range of activities across campus beyond the courses that they teach, working with your faculty, with your students, with administrators, various kinds of things to get engaged broadly across campus, but also, thirdly, to get engaged with your community outside campus, whether it's K-12 school or whether it's different kinds of fraternal organizations, whether it's media, whatever it might be. So it's done with the notion of internationalization in mind, broad internationalization. I think that's what sets this program apart from virtually any other Fulbright. And as Sarah said, it's really up to you to determine what exactly you want the scholar to do, what will they teach, what kinds of things will they do across campus, how will they engage with your community outside campus. It's really it's a blueprint for you to design.
Great. Thanks so much, David, for that. And David, we'll have him kind of provide his insights from the Department of State throughout this presentation to really, you know, elevate this presentation on kind of the overall arching goals that they have. So moving right along, one of the reasons that you as institutions have received this invitation to attend this webinar is you really are at institutions that we want to engage with. You've already hosted through the one function of the Fulbright program, and we really just want to work with you. Predominantly, the institutions served by the Scholar in Residence program are listed on the screen. So they come from minority-serving institutions, from community colleges, from small liberal arts, from rural institutions. And similar to how the Outreach Lecturing Fund is run, if you fall outside of kind of those really kind of targeted institutions, we still encourage and want to work with you. It might be through partnerships or something to that extent, but we really want to work with you and highlight this program as a resource that you can really use on your campus. We also, to kind of go with that last slide, we provided this breakdown of the institutions. So you can see it's broken down by the different minority-serving institution groups, by community colleges, and by small liberal arts. You also have a 24% that really don't fall into that. So again, it's not exclusive to just these institutions. If you do fall outside of kind of that targeted range, we are still here to work with you. So please keep that in mind and don't think this is not for me. Going off of that, David, can you also kind of elaborate on this pie chart as well and into the trends that you have seen with SIR?
Sure. So as Sarah said, we've got targeted type institutions, which are defined as institutions that are typically underrepresented in international exchange, don't have an opportunity as often as others to host visiting scholars and or serve minority audiences. So you see the listing of the kinds of schools that we're reaching out to, but it's not exclusive. So if you don't see yourself in this listing, then we say, might there be a way that you could do this, maybe partnering with another institution that does fall within this, these groupings. So I would say we probably see in a given year, you know, maybe a third of the grants or 25% are from the non-targeted schools, but they've partnered with one of the targeted schools. And the large majority of grants are specifically given to the targeted type institutions where we think that SAR is going to make the most difference. And it goes back to this whole notion of internationalization and schools that we think maybe are not as engaged with Fulbright as they could be. We'd like to see more of that happen. You know, Sarah talked about the targets for SAR and, in fact, the same kinds of targeted kinds of schools for the Outreach Lecturing Fund, those of you that have done that. And even with FLTA, while we don't necessarily talk about targeting the same kinds of schools, I think it's in the sense it's implied. I mean, for example, we'd like to see more community colleges get engaged, you know, with this program. Suzanne does such a great job at Davidson County, but there really are a handful of community colleges that are engaged in FLTA. So we'd like to see more schools do that and really see synergy between FLTA, OLF, and SIR.
Awesome. Thank you so much, David, for driving home those points. With that, it actually ends the first part of the portion that I will be presenting on, and I'm happy to pass the microphone over to Kaylee.
Thanks, Sarah. So we'll be breaking down the application components and maybe bringing in some input from our colleagues on the line from past host institutions. So we really do want to focus today's sessions around hearing from Vilma and Suzanne, so I will run more quickly through these sections. But a quick note on webinars is if you want a more in-depth look at the actual application components, then we held a webinar in early April that's posted online now, and that really breaks down these individual components. We'll also be having another application-facing webinar in May. And then in early fall, for any last-minute questions that people have about the application itself, that will kind of be a question-and-answer forum, so you can attend those if you have questions of your own or just want to hear what other people are working on. Okay, so the application itself is housed online through a system called Embark, and you'll see when you start an application that there's a shorter application form, so you'll be using you'll be entering text or using drop downs here, followed by a section that I'll get into in a moment that asks you to upload a number of documents. We do like to say and advise all the time that it's just really helpful to get in there and start the application. So as many of you know, if you've hosted and completed an institutional application in the past, you just want to log in and see what you're working with, see what you might have to gather. So I definitely recommend that you do that. There will be links, clickable links throughout this PowerPoint after it's been uploaded that you can access all of our guidelines through. So you'll be seeing that later as well. And then speaking of those guidelines, I'd also encourage you to take a look at those. They provide so many great details and are a wonderful resource speaking about all of these individual components. Okay, so for this first section of the application, you'll see on the screen here the individual components. It's more basic. You're just writing in names and contact information in the text boxes. I do want to highlight a few pieces. So there's two contacts listed here. One is your administrative official or anyone who can sign off on affiliation information. And then the other is the principal contact for academic arrangements. So for both of these contacts, we defer to your institution as far as how it's made up to determine who this appropriate individual is. As David was saying, we know that all of the institutions work differently and have different departments, so we don't have just a generalized option for this. It's really up to you and your individual institution. And then regarding program dates, we do work pretty far in advance, so you'll be listing dates in the 2019-2020 academic year at this point and in this current open competition. we'll be discussing financial support and then the named and recruited scholars in a moment, but you would just be listing the basic information here. And then lastly, there is a proposal summary that has a limit of 700 characters. So this is required. It's very helpful for us and for our peer reviewers to give a snapshot as to what your program entails, what you're proposing to do, and just highlight all of the major pieces that you want us to know at first glance. Okay. So now we're getting into this next section, which is called the narrative. So this is where those uploads start when you're actually in the application system. The narrative is divided into two parts, the first of which is the institutional profile. That would be 4 to 5 pages long, or if you were completing a joint proposal, as David had mentioned, you can apply with a partner institution in the area, you would be completing 7 to 8 pages since you're doubling the institution. Just keep in mind that our peer reviewers may or may not know your institution, so this is really key to giving them a better idea of who you are and what you're all about. So things in this section that you'd include are just general institutional information. We find that it's often helpful to just break these pages down by section. So you would be slotting a few paragraphs under the mission heading and under the academic offerings heading and then on down the line. So it just makes it a little bit more palatable to write and also to read down the line, but that's not by any means a formatting requirement, just a suggestion based on what we've heard from past applicants. And then what we mainly want to see here is how your institution is set up and what you have in place. And then on the other hand, what you might not have in place and that an SIR could complement or help to fill a gap in. So this section is where you indicate your institution's short and long-term goals and objectives as well. So you're writing what you're hoping to gain through internationalizing your academics and your campus, and then how specifically a scholar in residence would fit into these short and long-term goals. David, did you have anything you wanted to add about this narrative proposal section first?
No, I think this is good. I think that you know, as you think through this, think about talking about not only what your goals are, but what are your needs? Why do you want to bring a scholar to campus? What kinds of things could they add? And be creative about how you could, make use of the scholar in broad ways. Whether it's the kinds of things they're doing in terms of teaching, the kinds of things they're doing across campus, the kinds of things they're doing within the community, and even the kinds of things that you could see built into some kind of sustainability for what might even take place after the scholar returns home.
All right, thank you, David. And then Suzanne, did you want to add anything to this section with the institutional profile?
Oh, I was just going to talk a little bit about BCCC and how some people may think we are an unlikely candidate to host FLTAs or SIRs, but they've actually done wonderful things for our campus. And we are a medium-sized community college. We have about 3,500 full-time equivalent students. We have 28% of our student body is a minority. 40% of our students are first-generation college students. And 75% of our students receive financial aid. So just to say that if we can do it, anyone can, and there really is great value in bringing the world to your students through these programs.
Thank you so much, Suzanne. And all of those points that you've just mentioned are exactly what we'd want to see in this section. So those percentages and where the need is and where your students are from and just kind of everything across the board that you just mentioned. So thank you so much, Suzanne.
You're welcome.
So we will now move on to the second part of the proposal, this narrative section, which is where you show what the SIR program is really trying to accomplish for you. So Vilma, after I run through a few pieces here on this slide, I might hand it over to you for a moment just to see what your thoughts were when completing this section, but I'll just run through these really quickly first. Okay, so within the oversight section, you are addressing who on campus will be responsible and then for what during the entirety of a potential scholar's visit. So if you remember from that first section, we had talked about where you listed two contacts, the administrative official and the faculty associate. So you already have those two identified. So this section here is where you provide a nice background of those individuals, because before it was just basic contact information. So here you'll be saying what that particular person will be doing for a Fulbright visiting scholar on campus. So we have seen this section take a few different forms. There could be a few faculty or staff listed here. There could even be a whole Fulbright steering committee that engages staff from different college departments or backgrounds. Definitely take a look at some of the past webinars that we've hosted. Some of our alumni representation there, past hosts, were able to speak to some of these sections as well. So just let us know if you have any questions about this, and we can connect you with the appropriate resources. And again, this is all dependent on your particular institution. And there's also the academic program of the scholar. So here you'd be talking about what qualifications or background a scholar should have to meet your proposal's needs, and then even delving into the need for the courses themselves. So we do often get a question about how many courses a scholar might teach on campus. So we see on average around 2 per semester. This could vary, though, depending on all activities. So again, let us know if you have questions, but sometimes the scholar could teach a pre-designed course, so that's already been offered, and they'd be providing an international context into that curriculum. And then at other times, they are creating completely new courses for your catalog. So just really highlighting what they're doing and which of these types of teaching and courses they'll be helping with, because it helps the reviewers to understand how much preparation will be needed to go into these activities. And also be sure to discuss how the FIR will interact all across campus, even across the community. So this should show that you've really thought through how to maximize the scholar's time and presence in your whole community. And then, of course, as we've said, this is really an institutionally driven application and program, but we do want to see where there's potential for the scholar's individual growth, so the professional enrichment section there. So if they can be included in faculty meetings or attending any conferences that you ask them to join, so things like that you list in this section. And then sustainability. So David touched on this a little bit, but you'd be focusing on how you'd sustain the scholars' activities after they leave. David, did you want to provide any more insight on what this has looked like in the past?
Sure. So you think creatively about how do you sustain the impact of the scholar after they returned home. Maybe they do some online teaching. Maybe you end up with some kind of a student exchange or faculty exchange between your institution and your scholar's home institution. Think creatively about how do you sustain what the scholar brought to your campus, and how can you continue that after the scholar's returned home.
Mm-hmm. Great, thanks, David. Okay, and then lastly there we have financial support. So you'll be taking those amounts that you had just listed briefly in the application form, and then expanding on areas and what cost share you're able to provide. So just a note that cost share is encouraged, and institutions are asked to really think creatively of ways that they can provide this, but it's not required. It won't make or break an application. You won't be disqualified. So this could look like a salary supplement or in-kind support. So we've seen institutions offer meal plans on campus, providing or differing the cost of housing, public transportation, auditing classes. So here you'd be providing actual estimates of what those the salary supplement or in-kind support is valued at in this section. And then David, again, if you wanted to provide any additional insight here.
Sure. So beyond what Kaylee was talking about, you could have things like support to enable your scholar to go to an academic conference, It could be, ESL classes for perhaps a dependent of a scholar. It could be a membership at a local museum or another place where the scholar might be doing a bit of their own research. So think creatively about the resources that might be available to your scholar, whether that's actual cash, like a salary supplement, or whether it's some kind of in-kind support.
Great. Thanks so much, David. And then, Vilma, did you have anything you wanted to add to this section? If not, I know that you might be touching on some of this later, but...
I can say some of it now. I know at the institution, even though it's not required, what we do is we look at the average cost of a faculty member at the college and offer to pay for about half of the salary. And we request that Fulbright, or more specifically the Department of State, assist with half or slightly more than half. We've always offered some funds for conference travel, and those who have come with dependents, we assist them as well. So if it's a dependent of college-age students, then they can come and attend classes for free. Sometimes it's just English classes. Sometimes, depending on their level of English proficiency, it can be a little bit more than that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And as we've been saying, this really is dependent on each institution. So, David, did you have any numbers that you could provide of what you've seen in the past in this section?
Sure. So if you look at this historically, we've seen everything from $0 to $50,000in terms of a cost share. So obviously, you've got a huge spectrum there. But I think Kaylee's point is really relevant, that we understand that this is done case by case, that schools are in different financial situations in terms of what they could support, and we will work with you case by case. And please don't consider the fact that if you can't provide a salary supplement, that your application wouldn't be considered. We realize that that schools are in different situations. So if you can do that, great. If not, mm-hmm. are there other kinds of things that you could do to provide some kind of in-kind support?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great. And thanks to you both for that insight. Very helpful. Okay, so after the narrative portion, we then will be asking more information about the actual scholar that you wish to bring. So the program allows for two different tracks. You can either name a scholar or request recruitment of the scholar. For naming, you would be naming a scholar in your proposal that you possibly, a faculty member has worked with in the past or that you have some previous connections with. So if you name a scholar, you'd need to just outline why that particular scholar best fits your particular grant, since this is institutionally driven. So we ask that you submit a CV and two letters of recommendation, one of which should speak to the scholar's teaching ability, since they're coming to your campus primarily to undertake teaching. And then you'll also want to be sure that they have the required English skills to teach that topic on campus. And then if you don't have a specific scholar in mind or have those connections and that's no problem, you can request recruitment of a scholar. So you'd be asked to choose two different countries within one world region. All of this is listed on our website, and if you have a country in mind that's not listed, then just reach out to us and we'll be able to discuss and see what options might be available. But really what we're doing is using any details that you provide here to reach out to our colleagues abroad and see if they're able to recruit a scholar within that specific discipline or specialization that you're requesting. So just really get as specific as you can and outline the credentials of the scholar and if there's a certain amount of teaching experience they need or any degree requirements that they need to teach on your campus, as that really helps us to just narrow down our recruitment efforts. Then I know that we get questions a lot on naming versus requesting recruitment. So again, I might throw this over to David and ask for his input here.
So I would say that typically, if you look at this historically, the majority of proposals come in with a named scholar. But having said that, it doesn't make any difference at all in terms of your proposal, whether it'll be funded or not, based on whether you ask for a scholar by name or whether you ask us to recruit. The one thing I would say, if you ask us to recruit and you're listing two countries in the same region in which you'd like a scholar to come from, please make sure your proposal, we realize it's going to be more general because you won't know specifically who that scholar is or exactly what their skills might be. But if you're thinking about listening to countries, which we encourage you to do, then make sure your proposal, in fact, talks about, you know, a scholar from China would do X, a scholar from Japan would do Y, so that you, in fact, talk about both possibilities in the context of your proposal.
Perfect. Thank you, David. And we do know that there's it can be tricky to think in that abstract when talking about recruiting a scholar. So, again, use that draft proposal submission option and talk to us if you have any questions about how you might be writing all of this on the application. And then I think that we'll be hearing a little bit more from Vilma and Suzanne in a few moments about their scholars on campus and how all of that worked out for them. So, again, just use that question box in the webinar to ask any questions now, and we'll get to them later, especially if you have any for Suzanne and Vilma. Okay, so then moving on to the supplemental materials. Here we go. So there is the letters of support section for your application. So these letters should directly relate to your institution and what you're applying to do. Again, these are uploaded, so it's part of the upload section. And at a minimum, there should be a letter from the administrative official that you listed. But there is no maximum, so you can seek out letters from different departments all across your institution or neighboring institutions. If you're arranging community outreach and activities, and I think from like Rotary Club or high schools in the area or anyone who might be touching on or maximizing the use of the scholar's time. If you do include a letter of support, it's not by any means a binding document, so this can change. Some can be taken away or added down the line, but this just helps to show that there is a lot of support and excitement in your community hosting a scholar. Then we'd also like to see what the course or courses entail and get a sense of what they're about. So if you're naming a specific scholar, you might have that direct insight right away into what that specific scholar will be able to teach and craft and how it will enhance the outline or change the outline using their cultural perspective. And then alternately, if recruit, then just using all of these pieces to strengthen the overall application and say how a potential recruited scholar could fit into your program needs. Okay, so once you move forward with your application and click that submit button by October 15, then you might be curious about what the review committee is looking for during review. So as I just mentioned, really make sure that all of the pieces are working together and give a unified picture of what you're hoping to accomplish through hosting a scholar in residence. So what your short and long-term goals are and how that scholar in residence would contribute to meeting these goals. So we already did discuss most of these when running through the application component, so I'll just hone in on a few pieces here for you to think through. First of which is if the proposal is feasible within the time period. So again, if we see 5 courses proposed, then we might have questions about a scholar's feasibility to contribute fully to the program. Then you also want to expand as much as possible on the types of community outreach and engagement, along with creating a network across the institution, so really seeing that community and institution-wide commitment. And then when we hear from our host colleagues in a minute, I think we'll be able to see some of these pieces in action. But for now, I'll just hand it back over to Sarah briefly.
Great. Thanks so much, Kaylee. I think I have 2 more slides, and then we will pass it over. The slide on your screen right now, you can actually find on our website. It's just to really go over the review process and timeline so you can know when will I find out, you know, what are the steps. So as we said before, we do accept draft proposals up until October 1st. Obviously, you can submit them as early as tomorrow if you really wanted to, or if you wish to call us and just bounce ideas off with us to really, you know, bolster the application, we're happy to do so. The actual application, as I mentioned, is due on October 15th, so please, you know, go into the system, go into MBAR, get your application started, just, you know, kind of peruse around and see what all, where all you need to go to submit these pieces. After the application is submitted, it will actually go through kind of a tech review, and this is not where we're trying to exclude anyone or try to kind of cut the application pool. It's for us to actually see, did you upload everything? Did you accidentally miss something? Kaylee and I will be the ones to follow up with you just so we can get those pieces to say, hey, you might have actually missed this. It's just, it's really purely for a technical review. So when we do pass your applications on to the screening committee, they will actually have full applications. In December, we will have that external review committee. They will meet. They will actually determine, you know, which of these applications we can award through the Scholar in Residence program. In January, you will be notified what the result of that committee is, whether or not you are moving forward. And the next few kind of happen in concert with each other. So between January and February, ECA will actually be working with the Fulbright Foreign Scholarship Board to just kind of approve and make sure everything is good to go on those that were recommended to receive the awards, as well as IIE will confirm the institutional funding. Additionally, at that same time, if you did name a scholar, they will be confirmed with the posting commissions overseas, or if you asked for a scholar to be recruited, the overseas posting commissions will go ahead and do that as well. Once they have located a few candidates for your review, we will follow back up. That way you are the actual last person saying, yes, this is who we want on our campus. They make the most sense. So the power still does fall with you throughout that process. And then you kind of close it off in April to June with the grant packets being sent, and then hopefully in the fall or spring, depending on when you have stated you wish for them to start, they will make their way to your campus. And Kaylee mentioned this last page before I pass it off to you earlier. All these links are live. We will be sending out the application guidelines in the recording email after this is done and the recording is live. I will be emailing you with the location of the recording as well as most of these resources. So please just, you know, the best resource is either speaking with Kaylee or myself or going through the Scholar in Residence webpage as well as the Scholar in Residence application guidelines. They're pretty thorough and can answer many questions you might have. But I think that's enough from our perspective. We're going to actually kick off the host perspective from Suzanne. Suzanne, would you like to take over?
Sure, thank you. So on this slide, you can see photographs of two of the SIRs we've had here at DCCC. The first two SIRs we had came from China, and they both taught Chinese language and culture. So the photo on the left is of Ting Ting Hu, who was here on our campus, and that's a photo of her with one of our faculty members' daughters in the middle of campus during a rare snowstorm. We don't get a lot of snow in North Carolina. So both of these scholars were here before I became the Director of International Education. So I only knew them very slightly. I was teaching on a satellite campus at the time. So I became Director of International Education after the application had been submitted to bring Irina Petrovska to our campus, and she's our SIR pictured on the right. And she was an international communication instructor from Macedonia. And she worked at a university that focuses on tourism and hospitality. So even though I didn't have a hand in writing the application to bring her here, I was the person who dealt with her from the time she arrived, and she was a true joy, and I consider her still to be a very good friend. So she worked with her students. She taught intercultural communication. She did bring her husband with her, and her two college-age children came for a little while, and then they went back home. And I'll talk a little bit more on the next couple of slides about how she really did help the comprehensive internationalization of our campus. But going back to Irina for a minute, David was talking about the impact of scholars after they return home. What's really wonderful is that picture of me and Irina there is in Macedonia. So the year after she was at DCCC, she approached the U.S. Embassy in Macedonia, and she received a grant to bring me and another instructor from a community college in Maryland to Macedonia to give a week-long workshop on American culture. So I got to go to Macedonia, and it was wonderful. Subsequently, there was an artist from Macedonia that came back to DCCC and painted a mural in our learning commons for our students. So many years later, we still have close ties to Macedonia. We still keep in touch, and her impact is still strong, even years after she was on our campus. But yeah, you can go to the next slide now. So here you see a photo of all of our Fulbright foreign language teaching assistants. We have had 10 of them in the past 6 years. So starting in the upper left-hand corner, you see Jusaleia and then Ana. They were both from Brazil and taught Portuguese, of course. We decided to switch it up the next year with Valentina and Gada, and we had Russian and Arabic on our campus. And so we sort of finally found our sweet spot with Arabic. So for the past 4 years, we've taught Arabic at DCCC. This really enabled us to add another foreign language. The only foreign language we currently offer for credit outside the FLPA program is Spanish. So this program really enabled us to expand our language offerings. So for the past 3 years, we have taught Arabic and Irish language. And Irish may seem like a bit of an odd choice. I think we are the only community college in the world, probably, to have Irish language at our campus. But we offer an annual study abroad program in Ireland over spring break. We have a lot of people of Irish ancestry in North Carolina. And so this really has been a viable program, and it's, again, engaged the community and contributed to comprehensive internationalization. So you see here in our last 3 years, we have Virgil and Omar from Egypt, and then Jotham from Iraq, Rex and Jason, our twins we called them. And then this year we have Abdelkarim from Morocco and Jamie from Ireland. So they have done a great job too. And so in the next slide, I'll talk about some similarities and differences between the programs. So yeah, you can go ahead and do all the bullets if you want. So I think maybe I'll start with the differences. So, of course, the FLTAs teach foreign language. They teach their native language, whereas the FIRs can teach anything. They can be in any field. The FLTAs always come for an academic year, while the FIRs can be here for a semester. The biggest difference, I'd say, of course, is the age and the professional level. So the FLTAs are somewhere like a combination of student and instructor. They're usually in their 20s or early 30s. Most often they teach English in their home countries, and so when they come here, they're teaching their native language, which is a bit of a switch for them. And even though most of them are teachers already, that's not necessarily the case for every one of them, while the FIRs are, of course, professional professors. The application for the FLTAs is a little shorter and less complicated. Even though I wasn't involved in the FIR application, I did read it, and it seems quite lengthy and complex. The deadlines are a little quicker for the FLTA program. And, of course, our FLTAs take classes as well as teaching them. Where the similarities come in, they all teach undergrad students, so they're all involved in teaching our students on the campus. They require a lot of the same support. So I'm kind of the one-person office. Anything that has international in it, I do. I oversee all of our study abroad programs. I run our global scholars program. I deal with our scholars and international students. So I'm the one who does all the setup. I make the academic arrangements. I take them grocery shopping. I arrange for their housing, their computer training, getting their driver's license. All those things are pretty much the same because you're dealing with people. And most importantly, both programs contribute to the comprehensive internationalization of our campus. So in many ways, they are cultural ambassadors. Our students who probably are not going to study abroad for the most part get to learn about people from different countries. You know, having Jocelyn last year from Iraq, that was, you know, amazing for our students in rural North Carolina. And, you know, the teaching of Arabic has really just transformed our campus and the way our students see people. So they always do a great job representing their countries. They're super proud, and it's a wonderful way for our students to learn about the world. Every semester, we have a series of passport events where students can get credit or extra credit for attending these events, and our FLTAs and SIRs always give presentations about a day in the life of their country. They also help with our international students. We don't have very many international students on our campus, but we have a handful of J1s and a handful of F1s, and our Fulbrights are always very key into creating a community with those students. I mentioned our Global Scholars Program. That's a program for domestic students where they take globalized courses, attend passport events, and have a global experience like study abroad or a local project. And the Fulbrighters, you know, help with those programs too. So, and you can see on my last slide that they're always also a part of the wider community. Being a community college, community is key to our mission. So many times our scholars come with great talent, like Virgil was an amazing musician. So he played at International Night and other events we've had. The talent these people bring is really just amazing sometimes, and sometimes it's unexpected. On the upper right-hand corner, you see that we try to get everyone involved in community service. So there you see Jason and Jossam serving at a local soup kitchen. And our school writers do all kinds of things in the community to help out. They volunteer at lots of places. You see Irina over there representing Macedonia at International Night. Every March, we have a big, you know, festival with the food and the flags in our gymnasium. And hundreds of people from the community come to this event. We get lots of Girl Scout troops and Boy Scout troops and homeschoolers. It's always a big hit in the community. And in the lower right-hand corner, you see Jamie. He's reading a book. This was just a picture from this December at our Child Development Center. So we like to start young. We have a child care center for kids from birth to 5 years old. And this year, all of our international students and scholars went over there and read a story from their home country. So we like to globalize the curriculum starting at the pre-K level. And, it's hard to really talk about the kind of impact, you know, this handful of people have had on our campus over these years. But, you know, I can really just see a change in the attitudes of not only our students, but our staff and faculty. People are more open-minded and they have a broader perspective, and I think it really has made a huge difference in the campus community at DCCC.
Great. Thank you so much, Suzanne. And as again, we will have questions at the end, so if you have specific questions about how Suzanne's campus really went from that FLTA perspective and then have also kind of merged that with the SIR, please submit those. But with that, we're going to go to the other side of Vilma Fuentes, who really worked with OLF, and they also have now started to do a little bit more with SIR, and they use them in conjunction with each other. So Vilma, please take it away.
Okay, thank you very much. So if you could go to the next slide, please. Santa Fe College, we've been really honored to have hosted five different Fulbright scholars. The first one, Asna Hussein, was not a scholar in residence. Actually, she was part of a special program that I think has now been discontinued called Opening Doors to the Muslim World. And so she came here for a period of about 2 months, roughly. But it was a great opportunity for us to just test the waters and see, could we do this? You know, what would it be like? What things do we need to consider if we do decide to host somebody for an entire academic year? But as you can see, since then, we've hosted several other scholars from different parts of the world that have been scholars in residence. Next slide, please. So we've already reviewed the application process and all the essential components, so I'll just add a few little things. So in the proposal summary, as you've already heard, you know, it's really important that you highlight your goals and objectives. Like, what are you trying to achieve by inviting these scholars to your campus? In the case of our institutions, I think there's three common goals that we've had that have cut across all of them. And, you know, they've changed slightly from application to application. But basically, we want to always expose students and members of the community to a new region of the world that we deem to be of geostrategic significance or significance to our community. Second, provide faculty professional development, and I'll say a little bit more about that, but give them professional development and exposure to people from new areas of the world. So in the case of our college, we have roughly 250 full-time faculty, you know, hundreds more that are adjunct faculty. Our faculty come from all different parts of the world, but we don't have anybody from Indonesia. We don't have anybody from Ukraine. We don't have anyone from Brazil. We don't have anyone from those countries where we've tried recruiting scholars and residents. Anyways, and when you're writing your institutional profile, you know, in the case of our community college, we are not a minority-serving institution officially. We are not a Hispanic-serving institution. We're not a historically black college. But we always try to highlight what we are. And so, for instance, we highlight the fact that we do serve several rural areas and actually have educational centers in several different rural communities in North Central Florida. 70% of our students roughly rely on federal financial aid, and about 40% are representatives of minority groups. That's important because, you know, we want to make sure that we're reaching out to these individuals that perhaps normally wouldn't have access to scholars from other parts of the world. So taking someone from Indonesia or Ukraine to rural North Central Florida, yeah, that's a big deal. Some of those students maybe have never seen someone that's, you know, Muslim or someone that's from the Slavic, you know, Eastern Europe or Russia. And so it's really important to expose them to this. So what do you want to do with this individual once they come here? Well, that's really important. We always highlight the academic program. And in the case of our institution, we never we've never allowed a scholar in residence to just teach a class on their own. Instead, we've always paired them up with some of our faculty, and we have them co-teach two classes in the fall and two in the spring. The reason is we want to ease them into American life and our college life. We also think, and I can speak from firsthand experience, it's just an invaluable professional development opportunity. So, for instance, this year we're hosting someone from Ukraine who has a PhD in developmental psychology. Well, she was paired up to teach developmental psychology with another person here who, you know, has a PhD in the field. But suddenly they realize that there's this entire body of research that was done in Russia or the Soviet Union that we don't even know about in the United States. Just people that are, you know, we barely know about, we don't certainly don't teach about because, well, their work hasn't been translated into English. And so I know the two professors had these wonderfully rich conversations learning about how developmental psychology is taught in Ukraine and even in the former Soviet Union, and then how it's taught here. That's just one example. But of course, we don't just want them to teach. You know, so what campus activities do you have planned? Will they meet students? Will they work with student groups? So we have a really active Model UN team, and one of the countries, you know, every time we've had a visiting scholar, they usually adopt or try to represent a country from where the scholar is coming from. And so the scholar works closely with them. But then there's other groups that want to meet our representatives. And then we also partner with community groups, whether it be Altrusa or the local United Nations Association, the local libraries, the school districts, to see what we can do to expose our visiting scholars to teachers or students or others in the community. And then, of course, we're always very, very mindful about professional enrichment. We know that the scholar comes here hoping to achieve something, but we always allocate some funds. In the case of our institution, we allocate about $3,000 just for conference attendance. And for some of these individuals, this is just a dream come true because they might be coming from institutions where there are little to no professional development funds or the thought that, oh, they might be in Florida, but maybe they'll have funds to be able to travel to California or Chicago or New York to attend a conference is really powerful. And very importantly, it exposes them to a new part of the country that might have a slightly different culture and just kind of vibe. Because I think one should never lose sight of the fact that this is a program sponsored by U.S. Department of State, Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs, and the cultural part is really important. Anyways, next slide, please. I'm going to skip a few things just because I know we're running short on time and some of these things have already been addressed. But I think it's really important to think about the logistics, certainly of the first 2 weeks when the scholar is going to come. And I can tell you maybe, I think, mistakes we've made in the past and how we've tried to correct them. But finding housing, you know, I don't know, every institution is different. I've seen some institutions just send scholars to a web page and say, here, just pick any apartment or any place that's available to our students. Here's the long list with little guidance. And I don't think that's, I prefer more targeted guidance. And so what I do is I usually kind of handpick two or three places that I know have excellent access to public transportation, to local restaurants, to malls, to everything, so that even if this individual doesn't have transportation, can have their own private vehicle, they can still get around rather easily. So I usually send that to the scholar. I tell the scholar information about the cost and the amenities and all that stuff, and then the scholar will agree to it. But very importantly, most apartments want a contract to be signed in advance, and so that requires you to kind of intervene and see if you can negotiate something on behalf of your institution, and if they'll make a special exception and maybe not sign anything until the scholar arrives, or not pay the deposit in advance, or things along those lines. There was one scholar we hosted from Brazil that we got them a beautiful apartment, fully furnished, took them there, and then realized, what about everything else? Like, you know, toilet paper, soap, towels, just all these basic things you need just that first night or the first few hours. And this scholar had come in rather late that night. So everyone kind of frantically was running around. Ever since then, we make sure that we have like a big welcome basket for the scholars so that when they come in, they have those essentials that they need just to get started that first day. And then, of course, the first week or two that they're here, just really they need a lot of handholding, not just getting their bearings on where they are and how public transportation works, but also setting up a bank account, applying for Social Security card, and just it's really important to think, how is this scholar going to receive that first official payment? So IIE, or through the Department of State, right, they send the funds to the institution days before the scholar ever arrives, but that check has to be cashed somewhere. So where is it going to be cashed? And what we do at our institution is that we actually give the scholar an advance of, I don't know if it's $2,000, $3,000, just so that they have money on hand, cash that they can use to buy groceries and do a few other things while they go through the process of applying for a bank account and getting that set up and having the check from Fulbright clear. Next, please. Next. There you go. So again, I think it's very important to focus on the cultural aspect of Fulbright, not just the academic part. There's so many ways that that can be achieved. You know, you can take a scholar to, like in our case, we're in Gainesville, Florida. We've taken our scholars to Miami, to Orlando, to make sure we expose them to some of those big cities that they might be more familiar with from wherever they're coming from. Several scholars have said it's not until a football game that they really, really feel American culture. Okay, well, you know, it's important to expose them. Football, baseball, basketball, anything along those lines. Fishing, we've taken them to rural county fairs or to Civil War reenactment events, things along those lines. And something that the others on this call haven't highlighted is this is a lot of work, and it's really, it can be exhausting, incredibly pleasurable and rich, but in the perfect world, it would be best to not have just one person at your institution be responsible for this kind of social cultural planning, but rather enlist somebody else's help on the weekend and the evenings could also help take the visiting scholar to some of these local or regional events in the community and help expose them to American life. Food is really important. It's not highlighted enough here, but, you know, we're in the South. So, you know, exposing them to grits, gator tail, and fried green tomatoes and things along those lines is really, really important. Next slide, please. And this just shows some of the many ways that we've tried to use the Fulbright Scholars in Residence to then build long-term relationships. So obviously you've got the personal relationships that develop, and that naturally happens or doesn't happen in many cases. But every single scholar we've had here, as we have signed international cooperation agreements with their institutions that afterward have helped us facilitate student exchange programs, faculty exchange programs. We've worked together on joint grants. And so what you see in these pictures here are faculty from our institution and students from our institution traveling to those countries from where SIRs came here first. And this would have been absolutely impossible to do. We currently have like five international cooperation agreements that have opened up the door to the world for our students and faculty, and all of this began and it was made possible because of the Fulbright Scholars and Residents. Otherwise, it's very difficult to start an international cooperation agreement with somebody if you don't really know them and their country and their institutions and such. So if we click to the last slide, all I can say is, at least for us, Fulbright has been a really critical and indispensable tool in terms of helping us advance internationalization. And I say tool, maybe that's too harsh, but really, so much of what we've been able to accomplish in terms of internationalizing the curriculum, faculty professional development, and then creating new opportunities for students have occurred because of the programs that have been sponsored under Fulbright. So if you have never applied to host a Fulbright SIR, I encourage you to do that. It's an incredibly rich experience that will just open the doors to the world.
Okay. Vilma and Suzanne, we cannot thank you enough for providing that insight into everything from working on the application, who works with scholars while on campus, and especially hearing about those impact stories, so both professionally and personally, seeing all those pictures, like we love seeing it too, even here at IAE, and I know Department of State loves to see it too. I know that we are running a little short on time, so I do want to hand it over to David quickly to see if he has anything that he might want to add, and then we'll wrap up in a few minutes. So.
No, I think the presenter did a tremendous job sharing what they've done on campus with SIRs. You can see the experiences are varied, different parts of the country, different scholars coming from different countries, but you can see the long-term impact of this, and that's really what it's all about.
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely agreed. And I do just want to say again that we know that looking at the guidelines, there's a lot of information there, so just really get into that application. If you have questions, and if you pick up the phone and call the numbers that are on our website, or you'll get me. And then that SIR inbox, both Sarah and I are on the other end. So we're just really so happy to help with any little piece that you might need to bounce ideas off of about. We did actually receive one question, and I want to make sure that we talk about it briefly. And David, I'll pose this to you. So it's asking if it's possible to host for just one semester and if there's any summer residency options. So I believe that this university is on a quarter system, so a little bit different.
Sure.
Could you talk about that?
Sure. Yes, I mean, that would be doable. If the summer residency is the equivalent of a quarter, that's fine. And therefore the scholar could engage in the kinds of things they would do in a fall or winter quarter as well. Summer quarter being no different. On occasion, someone would say to us, if I have a scholar for two semesters, could we have them for a full year, full calendar year, including the summer? And we typically have said no because the summer period may be a downtime in a sense for you. We want the scholar to be fully engaged. So, the summer probably may not work as well for a school that's on the more of a standard academic year calendar, but if you're on a quarter system and your summer quarter is equal to the other quarters, then there should be no reason why a scholar in residence couldn't be with you for that time period as well.
Okay. Yeah, thank you so much, David. And as everyone is now understanding, it really is based completely off of your individual institution and what you're proposing. Okay, so up on the screen here, we just have some of our final contact information. We are on all forms of social media, so take a look at those. There's some great information on there, great resources, and also just stories. So like our host that joined us today, you can take a look at those. As we said, this presentation will be clickable, so you can click our website and email us at any time if you have questions. take a look at some of our webinars that will be upcoming, especially when we're getting closer to that application deadline, so that you can reach both myself and Sarah and just ask us any of those burning questions that you have left. But for now, I really do just want to say again, thank you so much to Vilma and Suzanne. It was wonderful having you on here.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you again for joining us. I know we're very eager to receive applications, and in about 2 to 3 business days, we will get this webinar recording to you all. But again, thank you to our hosts.
All right. Have a nice afternoon, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.